That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Is Totally 80s, the podcast dedicated to the music of the greatest decade ever. So, turn up your Walkman, loosen that scrunchie, and get ready to talk 80s with your host, Lindsay Parker.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Parker from Yahoo Entertainment and Sirius XM Volume, and welcome to another fabulous episode of Totally 80s. We love hearing from you, so why not take a second to follow us at Totally 80s on Facebook and Instagram, or email us your comments and show ideas to podcast@totally80s.com. And just a reminder, if you want to see our faces, and when you find out who the guest we have is today, you'll absolutely want to see his face. You can catch this episode on video as well on our Totally 80s YouTube channel, so go check that out. So first, joining me today, as always, is my partner in all things 80s, John Hughes.
Hey, Lindsay, I'm back.
Don't call it a comeback. We've been here for years.
We actually have been here for years now.
A couple years.
Yeah.
At least months. I don't know. Time is a flat circle these days. But yeah, don't call it a comeback. We have been around for a while now.
Exactly. But here we are. And I'm excited about today. I am.
Yes. So today, I think it's kind of obvious from my typical pun usage, what we're going to be talking about today. So our special guest today is someone who I think has had more comebacks and reinventions in show business than almost anyone I could think of. He is a musician, actor, and radio personality who's been entertaining us since the 1970s, fronting bands like Silverhead and Detective, and then checkered past with members like Steve Jones, Clem Burke, Nigel Harrison, Tony Sales. He also toured with another supergroup, The Power Station, replacing Robert Palmer, most notably at Live Aid, which was the first time you ever performed with Power Station, which is kind of insane. In addition to all that, if you didn't think that was enough, his acting credits include spots on Melrose Place, Seinfeld, Roseanne, Miami Vice, Northern Exposure, as well as countless voiceover credits. And you may remember when he reinvented himself to portray Murdoch, the arch nemesis of MacGyver, for the series of that same name. And if that wasn't enough, on top of all that, he currently is a DJ on Little Steven's Underground Garage every weekday from 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. Pacific on Sirius XM. But we, of course, here at Totally 80s, know and love him best as the man who, along with Holly Knight, co-wrote Animotion's amazing top 10 80s hit Obsession, along, of course, with portraying the lead singer of the immortal punk band Scum of the Earth on an immortal episode of WKRP in Cincinnati. So yes, I mean, that's a long resume. I think we're done with the podcast. I think I went on so long, we've run out of time. That's a long CV right there. Like I said, lots of reinventions and lots of comebacks. So that is why the Marquis himself is here today to talk about the biggest comeback stories of the 1980s. And without further ado, we are very happy to welcome to Totally 80s, the Marquis, Michael DeBar.
I'm exhausted.
I know.
Absolutely exhausted.
Can we just like reconvene tomorrow? I need a nap. You've done a lot in your life, Michael.
I know. I'm to hear you say it. You know, I love you, Lindsay. You know that, John. It's the first time we've met. Hello.
Nice to see you. Hello, everybody
out there. You know, yeah, I've done an awful lot. I'm 107 years old, but I think I look good.
You're looking all right.
I have a great moisturizer and no manager. You know, I manage myself.
Do you really? Is that
yes.
true?
With yes. All of- Yes.
Has that always been the case with all of these things you've done in your life?
Yes. All the decisions of all of those bands and everything I've chosen myself, because I learned very early on that it is not that difficult to sell myself.
You don't say.
You know, I know how to do that, you know, and I know how to take care of business on that level. And I think that's terribly important if you want to come back. My whole thing about comebacks is I should have a band called The Comebacks.
You should. You have several other bands.
You just keep at it. You know, you keep at it. All those things that you mentioned, every single thing you mentioned, you know, I'm proud of. I think it's great. And I really loved everything. There's nothing that I can remember that I didn't like, you know. So I do believe that one can, you know, create one's own career. I don't think you need anybody to help you.
Lindsay, we are 4.5 minutes in and we've learned the secrets are Lemaire, self-management, and loving what you do.
And a good attitude, which you've always had, Michael. But there's another secret to comebacks of the 80s in particular. When I was doing research for this podcast, I was looking through all the artists we're, you know, possibly going to talk about. And of all the people that seemingly, you know, came back against the odds in the 1980s, it seems to me the common thread that orchestrated the comeback in almost every case was MTV. MTV started in 1981, and they were, of course, playing a lot of new artists, and they were very instrumental in launching artists like Duran Duran and Culture Club and Madonna, and the list goes on. But they were also playing a lot of older artists because the people, you know, they were playing the artists that the people who ran the channel and the VJs grew up with, and of course they had many hours to fill. So in the middle of, you know, right next to Culture Club and Madonna, you'd see Tina Turner, you'd see The Kinks, you'd see Aretha Franklin. MTV,
lots of Rod.
He never really went away though. He wasn't really a comeback artist, but definitely a lot of the people that we're going to talk about were people that, you know, maybe you thought were going to be relegated to like dinner theater or oldies reviews, or, you know, that were B-list. And then along came MTV, started really pumping their videos, not just old videos, but, you know, a lot of these older artists got on board with making new videos that could compete with the kids. All of a sudden, they're the biggest stars on MTV. And I think the obvious one we have to start with is Tina Turner.
Yeah.
Because she's finally getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year without Ike Turner. She was already in without Ike, which is ridiculous. The fact that she, with all she's done, that she was only inducted along with someone who she had to come back from the debacle of what he had done to her career and life.
Well, it just gives you the whole notion of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, doesn't it? Which we won't go into. But Tina, you know, that's a fantastic observation. You know, she deserved it so much. The documentary is extraordinary. Talk about comebacks. I mean, leaving with nothing from Ike, nothing. You know, the kids going to Europe, boom, 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 big hits. I mean, it's a fabulous story. And it would make, it did make a wonderful movie with Angela Bassett, if you recall. But that is the major comeback. It really is. To go from sort of this country girl, you know, to create this iconic creature in the 80s is just so sexy and so mature and so wise. You know, and a Buddhist. Yeah.
How is she?
She went from the blues to a Buddhist. Yes. She's you know, mantras and praise every day.
But when you turned on MTV in 1984, you saw what's Love Got to Do with It and Private Dancer. You saw them in high rotation all the time. And she was definitely about 40 by then. How old was she by then?
Yeah, she was older. Yeah. She wasn't 18 like John Taylor.
But with those legs and that hair and that denim jacket, she looked like an MTV star right next to Cyndi Lauper and all of the people who were a lot younger than her. And it, again, like I said, MTV was important. But I love that comeback story because it wasn't just a comeback, you know, professionally, like she hadn't had hits in a while. And then she was having the biggest hits of her career. She was winning Album of the Year, the Grammys, et cetera. It was a comeback from great personal strife and tragedy.
And she wanted to be a rock star, Lindsay. Yeah. You know, she wanted to go from the soulful blues of Ike and Tina, which I adored that music. I mean, I love all of that stuff, you know, Nutbush, City Limits and those incredible songs. But she wanted to be a rock star. And she made rock albums, rock ballads, rock this, rock that. You know, the band was a rockin' band.
I just remembered. I just mentioned that you with Power Station played Live Aid in Philadelphia. That's where Tina Turner and Mick Jagger.
Yeah, I got together with her. Yes, I was in a room the size of a tiny little trailer with Jagger and Tina when they were rehearsing the song. I was in the corner trying to just absolutely stay alive.
Oh my God.
I was just, my heart was like being a beating like a big bass drum. And I thought, what am I doing here? This is insane. Apart from the fact that I'd only had one rehearsal or whatever it was, you know, with the passage, but to see these two be so professional about it and then go out on the stage and be so free.
Can I ask you, was the skirt ripping, was that?
No, you know, it wasn't planned. No.
Okay, that could have gone like the Janet Jackson, Justin Timberlake route. No, if that
perfect, yeah.
If that wardrobe malfunction or that skirt removal hadn't gone just right.
She had the words on her palm.
Oh. To the song?
To the Leviticus in the Bible. No.
Okay. Stupid question.
She had the lyric on her palm. You know, just going, you know, and reading.
Remember, I mean, Skate Shop was a current song. It wasn't like, you know, an evergreen tune. And
but yeah, do you remember this? I grew up in Los Angeles, as you know, John, and KIQQ, which was the big top 40 station in LA at that time, when State of Shock with Michael Jackson, and who obviously originally sang it with Mick Jagger, came out, KIQQ played it for 22 hours straight. They nothing else, but they didn't say they were doing it. They were like back announcing, like, and that was what's, you know, that was Girls Just Want to Have Fun, as if it was a normal day on the radio. But they kept playing State of Shock over and over. I actually called the station to say something was wrong, because, you know, as good a song as State of Shock is, I don't know if you need to hear it for 22 hours straight. I did forget that Tina Turner played it at Live Aid, but that actually says I could technically. This is just a thought that just randomly popped in my head. You could technically say that Michael Jackson was a comeback artist of the 80s. I mean, the fact that obviously he'd had hits and hits, but the fact that Thriller was, you know, the biggest, well, not only one of the biggest albums of the 80s, but of all time. I don't know.
And
if
the
anyone...
video was the longest and the deepest and the most interesting. I mean, the fact is that he could dance like a motherfucker, like nobody else. And, you know, video, empty video, the performance of MJ, forget about it. I mean, it's just, he was the absolute queen, king.
But when you talk about any boy band artist breaking out as a solo artist, I mentioned Justin Timberlake as, you know, he's a very modern example of someone who came from a boy band and then like became even bigger as a solo artist. I mean, the ultimate template of that is Michael Jackson and with Thriller.
And Harry Styles.
That too. That too.
But yeah, he did come. Yeah, from the Jacksons. It's an amazing comeback, an incredible story. And where's the movie? You know, I mean, that would be serious stuff.
That movie could go in several different directions. But the Tina Turner movie, I agree, was you know, a fantastic movie. But I also mentioned Aretha Franklin earlier. And, like, she was the other kind of big soul artist who came up in the 60s and 70s, who absolutely became an MTV star. And I mean this with no sense of shade. She didn't look like an MTV star, unlike Tina. She was not dressing super flashy. No. She looked like an elder stateswoman of R&B, and she was right there on MTV with Who's Zoomin' Who, Pink Cadillac, Freeway of Love, the George Michael duet, I Knew You Were Waiting. She was on MTV
incredible.
All the time.
Yeah, she knew what she was doing. I met her too, and you know, she was managerial also, because she'd been through such hell with men, you know, just pimping her, you know. And this is if not the greatest blues singer and soul singer and ballad singer, but she knew what she was doing. You know, most of these things about coming back is, you know, where you can fit in again. You know, it's just a professional attitude of knowing where you can place yourself. You, if you have that energy in you, you can recreate yourself. And only a handful of people have done that. And that's why this particular podcast, video cast, is terribly important. You know, I mean, it's a spectacular thing. Cyndi Lauper always comes to mind when I think about this. You know, she comes and goes and comes and goes per song. Right. You know what I mean?
Madonna too.
Yeah, Madonna too. God bless her. Oh my God. I don't know if you saw her on Jimmy Fallon the other night crawling across the table, but my goodness me, you got to give her props.
Oh, man.
You have to.
You have to.
We're big boosters here of Madonna.
We did a whole Madonna episode. So, yeah.
Should we use the word booster right now?
I mean, I'm pro booster. So, yeah.
I've got a band called The Boosters.
You have a lot of bands.
We have three albums out. Three.
You have a good point about knowing your worth and knowing where you can fit.
You got to do that, man. Look at Tina. You know, come on. But she's the classic one. Thank God we started with her, because she's the one that really came from a really criminal vibe, beaten up, all of that, and comes back and kicks ass, becomes the biggest star in the world. Are you kidding me? It's so beautiful. And she's so humble about it as well, and honest. That's the thing, telling the truth.
I will also say, since we're talking about biopics, a recent biopic, the Aretha biopic with Jennifer Hudson playing Aretha Franklin, Respect, is definitely worth a watch as well. With similar, not obviously exact same backstory, but similarly harrowing backstory, coming from overcoming a lot of adversity and persevering and, you know, having a career that spanned decades for sure.
Yes. I do think there is a part of it that plays into it, though. I wouldn't say luck, but people who know your prior work and respected it helping you come back. And I think Tina is actually an example of that. Do you guys remember how that all started?
Why don't you tell me how it all started? John, tell me how it started.
Well, she was asked to do vocals for Heaven 17 in the British Electronic Foundation for a cover of Ball of Confusion.
Wait, what?
What? What? What?
Yeah, 1982. And it was very hip. You know, you've got this synth pop thing happening in Sheffield. And for them to, they thought getting Tina Turner was a huge score. Like, wow, we got Tina Turner on our track. Whereas Tina's management was like, wow, we're with this really hip 80s forward-facing band. And then they went on to produce a one-off single for Let's Stay Together, the Al Green cover.
Yes. Yes. And I had so, no idea, and no, I'm actually embarrassed I didn't know that, but that is so cool. Yeah. That is so cool.
That helped get her a deal with Capitol. There was an in-house producer named Carter that kind of took this on himself and said, you know what? I'm going to do this. No one at the label believed in it. It was Carter's Folly is what it was called. And he worked and he got The Fix, you know, to come in and play on Better Be Good to Me, Cy Kernan, and Jamie West.
Yeah,
Got Rupert Hine to work on that as well. And all of a sudden he turned this album in and they kind of threw this single out there for Love, What's Love Got to Do with It. And they gave them a few thousand dollars for a video and boom, there you go.
How do I not know this? And not that necessarily Heaven 17 guys did this to get a medal or get any credit, but they should definitely be getting more credit. I don't remember in a Grammy speech or anything. I'm not saying, I just don't remember. Like, I don't remember anyone saying like, this is how the ball got rolling. No pun intended for Tina's comeback. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's not part of the legend at all.
It kind of bums me out because they do deserve a little props.
Of course, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's amazing information. I never knew that. I need to talk to my therapist.
It reminds me, you know, there's probably, you know, other examples of John or Michael that you can think of where like there was like a soul singer that sort of got brought onto another artist track. Like, you know, for top of mind, I'm thinking of like when Eddie Money brought, you know, Ronnie Spector on to, you know, Take Me Home Tonight. That was actually a little bit of comeback even for him. He hadn't had some hits in a while. And then he had big hit. And not only was Ronnie singing the hook, but she was like, in the chorus, like just like Ronnie said. So, and she was in the video looking fabulous. And yeah, there have been probably some other examples of these kind of, you know, artists that sort of got a second wind because, you know, a younger artist or a current artist gave them a chance.
And gave them a chance to come back. I mean, that's what we're talking about.
I'm taking a little, sorry to jump genres here, but I would argue that aside from Tina, the other biggest comeback of the entire 80s was because a younger, very different artist brought them on a track and it kind of got the ball rolling. And that was Aerosmith, which all started with Run DMC and Rock This Way. Aerosmith kind of hitched their wagon to two trends that were happening in the 80s. They hopped onto the rap thing, which was very new and very growing and doing
got rock. Other writers
that too that helped that helps but I don't know about
are
help,
you
but,
kidding are
I
you
mean it helped commercially
helped.
It helped commercially critically
well, commercially is what we're talking about, isn't it?
True fair enough. But you know, they hopped on kind of reluctantly, from what I understand it was like Rick Rubin's idea, but they hopped on to the growing rap thing with Run DMC, who were like the first really big MTV rap superstars. And it absolutely exploded their career and started kind of a new genre and like boosted both the bands. And like, you know, rap rock became a thing for better or worse because of that. But then, and that was Run DMC, a young upstart band bringing them on. But then they kind of hitched their wagon to another trend, which was in the late 80s, all of the hair metal stuff was huge. And all of those bands, Poison, Motley Crue, Warrant, Guns N' Roses, list goes on. All the Headbangers Ball bands owed a debt. They worshipped Aerosmith. And when Aerosmith came back with like Pump and Permanent Vacation, they were on Headbangers Ball alongside all those bands, still looking the part, still sounding great. And they had these epic videos. Again, MTV's so important. Like epic, like VMA winning videos, videos with Alicia Silverstone in them. And then Aerosmith became the biggest band in the world for a long time. And people, I mean, you remember this, Michael, people thought Aerosmith were like done. No one was expecting them. Like the when they got back with Joe Perry and Tyler and Perry got back together and they did the Done with Mirrors album, like no one was like, what a great comeback. Like people thought Aerosmith were over.
You know what else did it, Lindsay and John? Sobriety.
Yep.
Steve and Joe got sober and got it together and said, this is the only band. This is the original five members for 50 years. Aerosmith. Wow. But I must say that it is Desmond Child and it is all of the great writers of that time that put them back on the map. The songs are what count. And, you know, you can say that they inspired all of these hair bands, you know, most of which were, you know, shall we say, uncool. You know,
I think can say that. I love me some Motley Crue and Poison.
I think, oh, me too. I like Motley Crue, but I think that the whole thing about Tyler and Joe is they're Mick and Keith. You know, there is a certain pathway that I think Aerosmith followed very cleverly, but supremely talented. I mean, an absolutely extraordinary band that stayed together, but had the common sense to get a better producer and get better writers. I mean, that's really what makes you is the tunes. Yeah. The songs really make, I think so, you know, and I think in terms of all the hair bands, I think the Dolls had more of a physical influence than, you know, Steve and Joe, because Steve and Joe in the beginning were like Mick and Keith, and then suddenly they became very, very theatrical, and Steve became Janis Joplin.
Yeah, but yeah, the fact that this comeback that they had, when we're talking about such unlikely comebacks or comebacks that at least at the time I didn't see coming, it started with Run DMC. And
oh,
then,
yeah, unquestionably, the rap vibe to put them back on the map. But then they really, you know, mined that gold mine, didn't they, in other ways?
People back then thought that rap was a passing fad, that this was something that would go away in like a couple years. So having Aerosmith get on Run DMC's track actually, of course, helped them. But the fact that, you know, this supposed new gimmick, rapping, that some people didn't believe in, rebooted a career of a 70s, you know, hard rock band. It's like, you know, where's their biopic? I want biopics for everybody.
Yeah, that's brilliant. There should be a biopic. Absolutely. Who would play Steve Tyler? Miley Cyrus.
Perfect.
not a bad casting. Well, on a side note, since we're sort of talking about, you know, younger bands paying respect to an older band and that reviving the older artist's career, and we're also sort of on the tip of hair metal, there's the whole Slade Quiet Riot phenomenon. Like,
yeah.
Quiet Riot were practically MTV's like house Slade cover band. They didn't cover just one song. They covered, obviously, Come On, Feel the Noise, which made Metal Health the first metal album to go to number one. It actually displaced Thriller by Michael Jackson the charts, which was a really big deal at the time.
But then
they did, yeah, rest in peace, Kevin DuBrow. But then they did Mama, We're All Crazy Now. And suddenly we have all these VJs like Martha Quinn on MTV talking about, oh, this is a Slade cover. I will freely admit, I did not know who Slade were at that time. I'm, you know, obviously you probably knew Slade, Michael, or probably
I did. And Kevin DuBrow was a brilliant guy. He adored British 70s rock and roll bands, you know, like, and Slade was like, you know, royalty in England. Noddy Holder had one of the great Joe Cocker, Stevie Marriott, that throaty soulful, but he wrote songs that were killer. Killer commercial songs, and Kevin had that vibe. He loved Stevie Merritt. He loved Humble Pie, and he was a beautiful guy. But again, you know, narcotics took him. God rest his soul. But they were really, as you say correctly, they were the first band to get to that metal vibe at number one. I mean, there was a major thing, and everybody else hated them. You know, other bands went, "Oh God, no, please, they're not cool at all."
But my point is, Slade, as you mentioned, they were huge in England. They were not huge in America.
No, nobody knew who the hell Slade was.
They were, you know, a glam rock band from the 70s. This band, Quiet Riot, covers two of their songs. They're both very big MTV hits. And then all of a sudden, Slade are all over MTV. They, like, MTV used to play Run, Run Away, like, pretty, like, decent rotation.
That's right. That's right.
And My Oh My. They both
My Oh My.
They both hit the top 40 here, which was so frustrating for someone like me who... I actually grew up with Slade, even though I grew up in Ohio, because our AOR station, WMMS, is one of the bigger AOR stations in the nation, very influential. They were all over glam rock. We got Slade. We got Susie Quattro. And so,
are you talking about WMMS?
I am, 101, the buzzer.
We're talking about Kid Leo right now.
We're talking
about
Kid Leo. We're talking, John Gorman, all those people. And they got it. So I got Slade early on. And then, so
it sounds like a disease. I don't know.
I was an early.
Yeah, I got Slade.
I'm Slade.
I got Slade. I have three boosters coming.
But to see them, for me, it was a little frustrating to see them come back with this, with the drum machines and the synthesizers, as opposed to Slade, you know?
Yeah. What are you going to do?
Yeah, it was nice. Right. You have at least to see them get finally recognition in the U.S.
Well, that opens the door to a comeback. It's, you know, a band that definitely was a fan of Slade and owed a debt to Slade. And interestingly, comeback drum machines and technology of that sort definitely was orchestral in their comeback. Now, they weren't like, okay, Pyromania was a really big album, so I'm not saying this was like a typical comeback, but when, you know, Def Leppard, who are huge Slade fans and from that era, obviously, when Rick Allen lost his arm in that car accident in the 80s, and obviously he was the drummer, and then they decide to continue with him as opposed to what, you know, frankly, a lot of bands would have done would have been to say, okay, sorry, you have one arm, you're no longer a drummer, you know. The fact that not only did the band continue and have success, but the album after that, the album Hysteria, was
great.
Their biggest album ever. I mean, it's surpassed any of the hit albums they had before. And from what I understand, the producer, Mutt Lange, he actually worked with the limitations that Rick Allen had as a one-armed drummer, because he was using, you know, I'm not an expert on this kind of technology, but, you know, whatever technology to compensate for what he would have done with his other arm, and sort of using electronic drums, which was anathema to a lot of hard rock bands then. But like, they basically created a new, like, high octane sound on songs like Pour Your Some Sugar on Me. They're the ultimate example of lemonade from lemons situation. And I call that a comeback. It's not a comeback where like they hadn't had any hits in a while, but I'm sure everyone in the band, management, when they heard about Rick Allen's accident and that Rick Allen was going to stay in the band, I'm sure no one expected Hysteria to be the result.
Well, they came back from tragedy and made them even bigger. You know, the other thing of what you mentioned is, in passing, is Mutt Lange. Mutt Lange created that record. You know, I mean, he is one of the greatest rock and roll producers of all time and has made many, many, you know, but they were smart, you know, they stuck together. And I think that the inner consciousness of their fans going, what? You're keeping your drummer? I think that was very, very important in their comeback, because it's such a beautiful thing to have done.
People rallied for them, rooted for them.
They rallied, yes, exactly. They rallied for this wonderful guy, you know. They're sweet guys and wonderful guys. And then they made this killer album, you know, which is just it's a beautiful story and a perfect comeback for this particular vibe here that we're talking about. It's beautiful. Yeah. It's very, really, you know, uplifting when so many things are downlifting.
Well, there are quite a few, you know, if we're getting into this kind of this train of thought, there's quite a few comebacks where it's more like they overcame tragedy. A band member died, for instance, and you just absolutely thought it was over. And, you know, I mean, we got to talk about AC/DC. That is like the fact that they replaced Bon Scott, who's one of the greatest rock frontmen forever. And they did Back in Black in 1980, and that became one of the biggest selling albums of all time.
Of all time, yeah.
And AC/DC became bigger than ever. I'm sure a lot of their fans did not see that coming. That's an ultimate rock and roll against the odds comeback.
There's a biblical vibe there too, because I knew Bon. I knew him really good.
Oh, you did?
Oh yeah. London, and he died in London. Yeah. But what was dramatic and brilliant about that was this man called Brian Johnson, who literally could do that level of singing up there. It's really, really hard to sing up there, you know, but they found him. And that's pretty biblical in a sense, that Bon Scott, who had this incredible voice, and this guy, Brian, and then the album's the biggest album ever. It's a wonderful, wonderful reincarnative comeback.
I got to ask you, Michael, so you knew Bon Scott when, you know, I'm sorry for your loss. I don't know if you knew him around the time.
Like, yes, we were all fucked up. It could have been anybody that went, you know, but yeah, to be him, which was really horrible because the band was so exquisite. And then later, my band Detective, they opened for us in the Midwest. We did a tour with AC/DC. With Brian Johnson. And
really?
Yes. And I remember distinctly, out of my mind, in the dressing room, listening. What? I go out. I get in the crowd. I go, this is the greatest rock band. This is insane.
Were you surprised?
I was surprised, furious, and impressed beyond all measure, because they were so simplistic. I said, this is, you know, we were really complicated, sort of heavy metal Led Zeppelin, but like prog, but not, but, you know. And they were just rocking. And I thought, oh God, let's go back to the hotel and do coke. Yeah. I can't, you know, just take me away.
Yeah, that's a tall order. I'm sure you succeeded, but that is a tough act to follow when
ACDC. Oh, impossible. No, we did not succeed at all. You know, they blew us away completely. And we were all stoned and stupid. And they were like drinkers, but just really in control, man. Angus, oh my God, Malcolm. Malcolm especially. It was an amazing band.
I'm just asking, when I asked, if were you surprised, knowing Bon and knowing what a, you know, amazing frontman and fearsome talent he was, were you surprised when you witnessed Brian on stage?
Shocked
that he pulled it off as well as he did.
Absolutely, completely shocked. Yeah, you know, and I saw that version very early on with Brian, and I thought, my God, you know, they've done something that is clearly something that's very spiritual. I felt, you know, because that music is a trance-like music. It's sort of very, very sort of you know, catchy and controversial and powerful and loud and teenage and young and, you know, all of that stuff. And he captured all of that, but he was every man. He wasn't a gorgeous, you know, front man. You know, he was a tough, like, a hat. And it's all about that. It wasn't like Mick, you know, it was like tough and strong, like Bon was. Mm-hmm. He always like showed his body off, Bon, you know. He's a beautiful guy and had a lot of balls, and Brian took those balls and rocked them.
For those about to rock, we salute you and your balls.
Indeed.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Well, similar idea. Yeah. Similar idea. Definitely different genre, but I think this qualifies. I'm sure, John, you'll agree. I think the whole Joy Division New Order thing is such an insane comeback. Obviously, you know, Ian Curtis, he committed suicide on the eve of what was supposed to be their U.S. tour.
Yep.
You know, Joy Division were about to be huge here. What's crazy is not only did they reconvene as New Order, not only did they go on that tour anyway as New Order with some mixed response at the time because, you know, people
they hadn't got it together quite.
But here's the thing that I only recently found out. So in retrospect, maybe this wasn't the healthiest thing to do. The surviving members of Joy Division did not even take a moment to process the fact that they had lost their lead singer, who was also their friend, who was young, who died by suicide. Literally, okay, so they had an inquest over the weekend, and literally the Monday after Ian Curtis's inquest, they reconvened and started writing the song that was a tribute to Ian Curtis. It was called Dreams Never End. But like pretty much the minute Joy Division was kaput, which they decided, unlike with AC/DC, for instance, that it was kaput because the lead singer had died, the surviving members met in a pub and said, what are we going to do now? And they decided to form another band, slightly different sounding band, and were bigger than Joy Division, not only bigger than Joy Division ever were, but probably bigger than Joy Division ever would have been had Joy Division continued, a more commercial sound, a more dancey sound. But, you know, I interviewed Peter Hook once for Yahoo, where he says, you know, that was an era where suicide and feelings in general, especially in the North in Manchester, were like not really discussed, not understood. And they were in shock and denial. And maybe in retrospect, it wasn't the healthiest thing to, like, 2 days after your lead singer dies, start a new band and get right back into the rehearsal space. But that's what they did, obviously, with commercially successful results. That's how they processed it. They were in shock and denial at the time. But the fact that New Order sprung from the ashes of Joy Division so quickly is shocking to me. And again, you know, an amazing story.
Well, it's really, I'm sorry to sorry, John, but the north of England is very stalwart. You have to be really ballsy to be able to exist in that, especially the working class. You've got to be really strong. And Ian Curtis was an anomaly. I mean, this was Jesus, you know, this was a guy, this was a real philosopher, very depressed philosopher. He was like some French existential author who offed himself, you know, But the others, right, we're gonna get going, and we're going to do it again, and we're going to write these great songs. And they did. And it's a miracle. I mean, it's beautiful that they could do that. Ian Curtis, replacing Ian Curtis, who was just a classic artist.
And the thing is when I interviewed Peter Hook about all this, he basically said that, you know, obviously, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this know, but if you don't, you know, Ian Curtis had epilepsy, and it was getting worse and severe, and that contributed to his depressive state.
It was the girl.
There was some of that with as well. Yeah. I mean, his life was getting complicated. He had an emotional affair going on with someone else while he was married and had a new baby. But his epilepsy was worsening. He was having these fits that were harder and harder to control. And he was hiding it from the band or minimizing it to the band. You know, even when the band was like, are you sure you're okay? You know, you just like collapsed and hit your head on a wall or something. He was like, I'm fine. You know, because again, that's stiff upper lip thing you're talking about.
Yes.
But, you know, they were also with their eye on the prize that things were going so well for Joy Division and the US tour was booked and that they, you know, didn't really kind of think about his well-being at maybe as much as they should. When he said, yeah, I'm fine, don't worry about it, they took him at his word instead of going, actually, maybe you're not fine. You know, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to keep?
Well, they were so young. They're not psychiatrists. Yeah. They're rock and roll musicians, you know, and it's a completely different thing. They're very, you know, they're adolescents and they're going to deal with this complex guy. I mean, it was impossible. They were probably glad in some dreadful way they could do it themselves, you know.
Whether it was, you know, psychologically healthy enough to compartmentalize that and just move on and, you know, close that chapter and start a new band. It obviously resulted in a great new band that had many hits. John, you were about to say something about the whole thing.
Yeah, I think Michael hit it all. You drank your feelings. And, you know, a lot of times with these bands, you don't have the time or the luxury to ruminate. You've got a contractual obligation you have to fulfill, like it or not. Or you lose a lot of money.
That is to my point that I wonder that had Ian not passed away and they, you know, presumably would have continued on for a lot longer time as Joy Division, you know, would it have evolved into more of the sound that New Order had, or would they have had so much success? Of course, there are very different schools of thought. You know, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like two different camps and Joy Division. There's like a meme going on. It's like a Breakfast Club meme where they show the Ali Sheedy and that's Joy Division, and they show Molly Ringwald and that's New Order, you know?
It's true.
But music is entertaining, for God's sake. Yeah. It's an entertainment. It's not like, oh, he's suicidal and epileptic, let's buy the record. Yeah. You know, I mean, you've got to give out good vibes. You can sing about sadness and breakups, but it's a song. It's not a fact. You know, we're here to entertain and make people feel good. And, you know, Ian was not in that atmosphere. No. You know, it was a different ethos he had.
No pun intended.
Yeah. Well, it was a different vibe he had completely. And the following band was a completely different band.
100%. Well,
speaking of good vibes, but also speaking, John, I want to let you have the floor for this one. In terms of bands that sprang from tragedy in the sense that they lost a key member and then got bigger than ever with the album that came out after that. Like, we got to talk about the B-52s.
Crazy. You've got a band who were indie underground, alternative rock, college rock, whatever you want to call it, novelty with Rock Lobster. Some people consider them. I don't consider Rock Lobster a novelty song. I think it's an amazing surf record. And then, you know, their commercial fate is kind of on the downside. And then they lose Ricky Wilson to AIDS in 1985. When they're making probably their most introspective, mature album that just gets completely overshadowed by the loss of this member. And
was that Bouncing Off the Satellites?
Bouncing Off the Satellites, probably my favorite B-52's record. You've got stuff like Ain't That a Shame, which Sinead O'Connor has covered. Wow. Just an amazing record. Yeah. And then...
And he was only, I should point out, not only was he only 32, which adds to the tragedy, but it's tragic enough to lose a bandmate, but he was also Cindy Wilson's brother.
Right. And so you've got this, and they were all best friends from Athens. You've got this event that destroys them emotionally. Unlike New Order, they took time. They took a sabbatical. They said, you know, we don't know if this is going to continue. They actually did a music video after that for Girl from Ipanema without Ricky. Mm. There's a nice little tribute where he's the sun and you can see his face. But then they just kind of withdrew, and then they just started testing the waters and getting together and seeing what would happen. And you've got Keith Strickland coming from behind the drum kit, teaching himself how to play guitar and writing songs. And then they do some songs with Don Was and Nile Rodgers, and it's kind of a lark. And they put it out. Channel Z is the first single. Why? I don't know why Love Shack was not the first single, but Channel Z kind of gets, you know, on 120 minutes and gets some play on modern rock radio. And then Love Shack comes out and it's like, wow, talk about a comeback.
Absolutely. And then the album Cosmic Thing that had Channel Z and Rome and Love Shack on it, that album in the US alone sold 4 million copies. I don't think anyone would have ever, back in the Rock Lobster days, thought that a band, a cult band, a college rock band, whatever, like B-52s, would have a quadruple selling album. And it was largely on the strength of Love Shack, which was on MTV all the time. Side note, the first time RuPaul was ever on MTV was in that video. And, you know, in the halter top, the lavender halter top and shorts, like kind of doing the limbo and the Love Shack. But that song was everywhere. It still is everywhere. It's like any wedding you go to, any bar mitzvah, you're going to hear it. I've actually heard it, honestly, too many times. If anything, I'm happy they had this comeback. If anything, it just kind of bums me out that a band as awesome as the B-52s are in the mainstream most recognized for that song. Because
they were so ahead of the game, you guys. Yeah. It was LGBT. Yeah, the whole thing that culturally... they were so ahead of their time, and yet they had hits. You know, it's not as if they did. It's an amazing story. It really is.
Where's that biopic?
It would be fascinating for right now. It'd be the clap. But you know, the movie makers, they don't want that. They you know, they want one person, you know, in the middle there.
No, I just think the fact
the
that
Mick,
you know,
Jagger story. You know.
Yeah. Also, like, what year did Ricky Wilson die? Was it 1985, John?
1985, yeah.
Live Aid time, yeah.
Yeah, so he died of, you know, complications from AIDS at a time when there that was still a pretty, the whole idea of AIDS, like, you know, being
shocking
in the news, it was still kind of pretty new. You weren't hearing about, you know, a lot of celebrities,
right,
you know, at least being open about the fact that they had it or yeah, that it was
still, it was still a sense of extreme shame.
Yes.
You had Klaus Nomi, I think, was probably the most notable person before that.
Very good.
Actually admitted, you know, that he had this. And I to go back to Love Shack, you know, it's a bummer that that's what people know them for. I do take solace in the fact that Rome got to number two.
It's a great song
as well, because Rome is an amazing, amazing single.
It is. And like the vocals on it, the girls' vocals on it are just like so robust and so awesome. You did mention, since we were talking about this, you mentioned that one of the producers on it for, and I know he did six of the songs on Cosmic Thing, was Nile Rodgers. And I think we should talk about him because he had quite a comeback as a producer in the 80s. We have to remember the 70s ended with this bullshit disco demolition night in Chicago where, you know, the night disco died. It was a very homophobic and racist event. Yep. And it's weird to me that it had such, you know, in a time before social media, that it went viral in its own way, got reported on the news, and actually quite literally killed off disco. I mean, disco still existed.
And the Bee Gees.
Yeah. It hurt all these people's careers. And, you know, Nile Rodgers has talked about it a lot in interviews. But then in the 80s, he had, I mean, disco didn't die. It just started being called other things. Dance
R&B,
music obviously
yeah.
didn't die. But he had a comeback, Nile Rodgers did, in the 80s. He was producing, like, it started in 1980 when he co-produced the Diana album for Diana Ross that had, like, Upside Down and I'm Coming Out. But then
David Bowie
and Let's Dance, Madonna Like a Virgin, the stuff he did with Duran Duran, the Reflex remix, the Notorious album. I actually just recently realized that he produced INXS's original Sin, which is my favorite INXS song.
Yeah.
He became... absolutely, like, and he's had many comebacks because, I mean, even in the recent
years.
He's
still coming back.
Daft Punk and other things he produces. But in the 80s, like, I think it was actually, correct me, John, you'll know this, like, it was the Let's Dance project with David Bowie that kind of really put Nile out there as a in-demand producer for 80s acts.
It was an amazing rebranding as, you know, here's the mastermind behind Chic. Chic. Thank God they're in the Rock Hall. One of the most underrated bands of the Rock.
Tony era. Thompson.
Yes. And you know him, don't you?
I did. You
shared a stage with him.
I sang with him and played with him for 6 months of my life. And he was the greatest drummer ever, you know.
Not only did he come back from the disillusion of Chic, he came back from a production misfire with Debbie Harry and Cuckoo.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, which I love that record, but people did not at the time.
Wow, how interesting. That's true. Yeah, Debbie. A lot of
that came down to the album cover. I think the album cover freaked everyone out. That
That could be it.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. Yeah.
Backfired is a great single. And he was already kind of out as a producer when he just started moving into this direction. So to have Bowie pick him to produce Let's Dance, or EMI, depending on who you talk.
Well, Stevie Ray really loved it. Niall, it's a very long story about all of that. But I mean,
is it a story you'd like to share with the group, Michael?
Well, the Bowie, that was a specific task that David put upon himself, was to make the biggest fucking record he ever made. And this was his plan, which to me is the most exquisite thing, because after all of that, he did what the fuck he pleased, because he'd shown that he could play to 60,000 people, and then he could go to Berlin with Iggy, you know. So it's a very interesting vibe. And of course, everybody turned to Niall. Niall was the groove guy. That's that, you know, the whole fucking groove of it all. Niall Rodgers was Mr. Groove and remains so to this day. You know, he's a very active social media, Lindsay, mm-hmm. John, I'm sure you're very aware. You know, he's never got, it's interesting to see use of the word comeback and Niall Rodgers in the same sense, because he never went anywhere.
Yeah, reinvention, I think,
That's the vibe. And that was Bowie, you see, because obviously David would reinvent himself every 20 minutes, you know. Today I'm sort of Greta Garbo, and tomorrow I'm Steve McQueen, you know, which is the title of my autobiography, incidentally. But
love that.
But, you know, amazing. Niall, come on, fantastic. I just love him. I mean, love him.
John, did you have more thoughts about how, like, the Bowie thing kind of was very important to Niall's production discography?
It sold millions. That's what,
they put him on the map as a producer, and he was the hot guy for much of the 80s. You had Duran Duran grabbed him for Notorious.
Mm-hmm. And Bernard.
Well, obviously this is going to be way too much for one episode, so we're gonna all have to wait for it, come back for part two with Michael DeBar and John Hughes. Join us next time on Totally 80s.
This was Totally 80s, the podcast dedicated to the music of the greatest decade ever. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Totally 80s, and please leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Until our next episode, catch you on the flip side.